It feels like it's been a while since we've had a And Things episode, so today we're talking poetry with our guest Christopher Kokinos.
We're also talking about the moon, as his latest book is all about the history of the moon.
Do you have any favorite space poems or ones that have to do with the moon? Let us know on social media. You can find us at Space and Things Podcast on Threads, Instagram, and Facebook, or use the contact form on our website, spaceandthingspodcast.com.
And please consider joining us on patreon.com/spaceandthings. But right now, it's time for episode 192 of the Space and Things Podcast.
Oh my God.
I'm Emily Carney.
And I'm Dave Giles, and welcome to episode 192 of our podcast. Emily, how you doing?
I'm doing great. I was very blessed last week to go to Greenville, South Carolina for a three-stall studio's opening of an exhibition called Space Exploration, Past, Present, and Future. Andy Saunders was there, who wrote Apollo Remastered. As you may know, it has these amazing prints in it of Apollo imagery. And Charlie Duke was there as well.
Amazing.
And Sterling Crawford was there. And she is Charlie's granddaughter. Not only is she Charlie's granddaughter, but she's an amazing fine artist. And a new portrait of Charlie was unveiled at this event. It was wonderful. It was very moving. Greenville, South Carolina is exquisite as well. If you haven't been there, you got to visit there someday. I did a little bit of sightseeing, and that was a lot of fun. But I think it's appropriate to mention this because this week's episode is all about the moon, and it's all about poetry also.
Yeah, of course, because Charlie Duke walked on the moon 52 years ago on Apollo 16. And today's guest, Christopher Kokinos, has just released a book about the history of the moon.
Christopher is the author and co-editor of several books, including The Fallen Sky, An Intimate History of Shooting Stars, Hope is the Thing with Feathers, A Personal Chronicle of Vanished Birds, and Beyond Earth's Edge, The Poetry of Spaceflight. He is the winner of awards and fellowships from, among others, New American Press, the Whiting Foundation, the Rachel Carson Center in Munich, and the National Science Foundation. His poems, articles, and essays have appeared in such venues as Scientific American, High Country News, AstronomyDiscover.com, and the Los Angeles Times. Having taught literature, writing, and science communication for more than three decades at three universities, he again lives and writes in Utah.
His new book is called Still as Bright, An Illuminating History of the Moon from Antiquity to Tomorrow, and is described as an immersive exploration of the nightly present that has captured our imagination for the entirety of human history. That sounds pretty epic to me.
Yes.
It's not a poetry book, but his poetic storytelling certainly makes it particularly wonderful. So let's have a chat with Christopher Kokinos.
What happens when a musician and a writer get together to make a podcast? Something.
Welcome, Christopher. Thanks for joining us today. Now, we love to find out an origin story. So what contributed to your fascination with space and spaceflight?
Oh, gosh. Well, the origin story goes back. There's sort of two phases. One is childhood, of course, as most of us have that childhood wonder, which kind of comes into play in the book Still as Bright, the role of wonder in our lives. So I grew up a child of Apollo. I watched the first moon landing. A vivid memory of that in a rather unhappy family situation when I was growing up. The space program was a kind of aspiration, kind of hope for something better. And I remember have vivid memories of with a little cassette recorder. I wish I still had a tape recording, you know, Walter Cronkite and Jules Bergman, these famous newscasters and space correspondents. And I would replay those those tapes in my bedroom when I was a kid. And then as I grew up, of course, I wanted to fly. I wanted to be an astronaut. Then I was literally pulled out of advanced algebra, which is one of the traumas that I remember most. And that set me on a different path. And then fast forward to being in my early 30s, and I bought a telescope that also functioned as a spotting scope. I was working then on a book about extinct North American birds, which is not the most uplifting subject matter. So I started looking at the sky and hadn't, you know, really done that since I was a child. But my interest was in galaxies and nebula and, you know, the faint fuzzies, as we call them. Then my interest shifted to the moon. A few years ago, I was living in Tucson. I'm now back in Logan, Utah. Then I was sort of struggling with place and profession. And my telescope had been gathering a lot of dust, and I wasn't taking it out. You know, I was too tired to drag it out of the city lights. And then one night, there was the moon. And I thought, I haven't really looked at it. Of course, I've looked at it, but I hadn't really looked at it. And that that set me on this path to writing a book about the moon from antiquity to tomorrow.
So a few years ago, you edited Beyond Earth's Edge, The Poetry of Spaceflight, which is a fine book. I have it. An anthology dedicated to poetry as diverse as Anne Sexton to Apollo 15's Al Warden, who actually went to space and visited the moon. Yep. Do you find poetry depicting space and astronomy changed during the space age compared to maybe earlier times when space was completely unexplored? And how did it change?
Yeah, Beyond Earth's Edge was also part of that sort of return to thinking about human space exploration in a way, you know, as a writer. And Julie Swarstead Johnson, who was the other editor there, really sort of pushed that project along. She's a poet and fellow space enthusiast. And going through the anthology and thinking about it historically, what I was struck by was a change in how creatives were responding to Apollo. It was largely, well, I would say negative or with some hesitations. We'll put it, you know, mildly. Anne Sexton, as you mentioned, had no problem criticizing Apollo. What's happened since, I think, and it was really because of the blossoming of robotic space flight, you know, the great missions to the outer solar system, there's been a real sort of renewed interest among younger poets that, again, sort of taps into that aspirational sense of what space flight and space science can tell us about our place in the cosmos, and to do so in a way that embraces a sort of vibrancy. If we imagine a future on this planet and on the moon and on Mars and elsewhere that is just and vibrant and sustainable. And that was really encouraging to me, because the Apollo poems in that anthology aren't very celebratory. There are some that I think, you know, Archibald MacLeish's famous poem, Voyage to the Moon, which was on the front page of the New York Times after Apollo 11 landed, maybe an outlier in that way. And certainly prior to that, of course, before rockets, before we were thinking about these things, the poetry of space is embedded in spiritual and folkloric and mythological traditions as well. And you know, that sort of pays forward a little bit to the present. You know, the moon, for example, is still a very important object to a lot of people in terms of religious belief.
So your newest book, Still as Bright, discusses the moon as viewed by many different people throughout the centuries, including you, via telescope, as we talked about a little bit earlier. Yet, you know, many people view the moon as sort of an inert satellite just covered with rocks that doesn't really do anything. This is a huge question, but what things capture our imagination about the moon, which is, you know, something we've seen, you know, unless you don't have eyesight, unfortunately, but the moon is something that most of us have seen our entire lives.
Right. So that your question reminded me, there was a headline in The New Yorker after the Apollo 11 landing. The headline was something like, you know, just one big rock pile, you know, and Carl Sagan famously called the moon boring. The Apollo 8 crew, and I have great admiration for these astronauts, but the Apollo 8 crew's initial descriptions of the moon were kind of negative, actually. They were, you know, foreboding, a vast expanse of nothing and so forth. So we have this multivalent relationship with the moon, as you say. I tried to embrace as much as I could within the constraints of you know, a reasonable length book, cross-cultural, cross-temporal mythology, the moon as a deity, the various shapes that we've seen on the face of the moon, and some of these shapes we could, you know, the man on the moon, rabbits, foxes, claw marks. So, you know, we've been trying for a long time to understand what this light in the sky was. And that's part of, I think, the compelling story, is that we've sort of forgotten that. In fact, the book begins in prehistory with a bone that was found in France, about 45,000-year-old bone, with these little incisions. And scholars have interpreted this as, you know, one of the first documents of lunar timekeeping. And one of the arguments that, wow, that Alexander Marshak makes, who's the scholar who looked at that most assiduously and originally, he has, I think, a beautiful way of thinking about this. Like, this is sophisticated timekeeping. This is science. Like, this is prehistoric science, right? The moon's movements across the sky, we may glance at it every once in a while when there's a beautiful full moon, but if you really watch it, it's like moves across the sky. And of course, there are the phases. It's kind of complicated. So this was prehistory and science in a sense, right? And he argues that this is one of the reasons we became self-aware, that the moon played a role in that. We can't prove that, but I think it's a beautiful supposition. And we carry that forward to the really colorful history. The moon is an archive. It's an archive of religion, of timekeeping, of art, of symbolism, and exploration, and science. And to the extent that we're familiar with the moon, because we might glance at a beautiful harvest moon coming up, or a partial eclipse, or what have you, and that's beautiful and important. There's so much more, and it's not inert. As it turns out, there are moonquakes. There are little puffs of gas that come out of the moon. And as most of the listeners to this wonderful podcast will know, there's water ice on the moon. And that's why we're going back. So I think a new look at the moon to sort of embrace the past, understand how that tells us who we are in relationship to the nearest world, you know, a world that we can see the surface of in great detail with our own eyes. That tells us, I hope, a lot about, you know, what might come next. The other thing I would say is, yeah, this is also, telescopes are important in this book. So there's a bit of a memoir element as I embrace the cultural, historical, and scientific material and explore that. It's kind of the story of a boy and his telescope. I had one when I was a kid, and now I have one, you know, in the latter half of my life, and I use it to explore this world. You don't have to own a telescope to look through one. Nearly 1,000 libraries in this country have telescopes that you can borrow. And so one of the things I just encourage people to do is, especially people who are thinking about the moon from a policy point of view or an engineering point of view, is look at it, because it is a place and it's majestic. And that, I think, inculcates or should inculcate in us a certain approach to how we go back. And I want us to go back.
That's great, because that leads us right to the next question. So many entities, including NASA, have renewed interest in visiting the moon. So what are your thoughts about current lunar exploration and perhaps even, you know, in the future, habitation or something like that, people staying on the moon for long, long periods of time?
I think it's exciting, and I think it's challenging. And I happen to be on my good days. I have my bad days. On my good days, I feel like we can walk and chew gum at the same time. In other words, we can engage in space exploration and space science and settlement while addressing the wicked problems that we face here on Earth. And in fact, I think Cyan Proctor often says, the inspiration for Pilot says, you know, space solves for Earth. And I think that's correct. So going back to the moon gives us a chance to try to learn, as I put it, the art of solving problems without creating new ones. Now, that's aspirational, and we may not get there, but I think it's a good way to approach this. So I'm excited by all this activity. It is challenging. There are lots of policy discussions that have to happen. I'm a poet and a science writer. I'm not a policymaker. I'm not an engineer, but I've been steeped in this for the past several years and will remain so, because I'm excited by this human return to the moon, Artemis and the Chinese National Space Agency. But, you know, as the listeners will know, it presents a whole host of questions. You know, who the moon, you cannot claim national sovereignty on the moon, but the lunar South Pole is where we're headed, because that's where the water ice is, and that ice can be turned into liquid sustenance. Astronauts can drink the moon. They can breathe air. They can make hydrogen fuel. So how do we go to those places respecting each other's operations, not putting human lives at risk, right? But also respecting the beauty of the moon and the majesty of the moon. And one of the stories or sort of chapters of the history I delve into is in the 19th century, these astronomers who were using telescopes, selenographers, and, you know, that's sort of the first exploration of another world. And it's so moving to me to go back and read how they describe craters in mountains taller than anything on Earth, and these, you know, complicated, huge, beautiful craters. And they use the language of the sublime. And again, that sort of sense of wonder. So I'm hoping that that informs how we go back, you know, even to the level of the kind of infrastructure that we'll build out. So, you know, as we have humans living on the moon or working on the moon, maybe we'll have architects and designers, and I know there are people working on this, making our habitations there part of the environment, not an imposition on the environment. And that helps us think about how we can take these gifts of the moon, resources, if you want to call them those, and use them, of course, but to do it with a sense of stewardship and sustainability and gratitude, frankly. The moon, we're largely here because the moon, right? Protoplanet hit the Earth, smacked the moon into being through this complicated, messy formation process, and the moon keeps us in the 23x degree axial tilt that we have. We have seasons because of the moon. So it's played an outsized role, and it would be ungrateful for us to just go up there and tear a big strip mine across the man on the moon. I don't think we'll do that, but we do need to think about these questions and widen the conversation. So it's not only the space community, but everyone who looks at the moon has a say in this.
So back to poetry. Still Is Bright talks a lot about moon poetry, and obviously Beyond Earth's Edge was a lot about poetry of spaceflight in general. So the moon has inspired poetry, writing, art over the last, centuries. How do you reconcile the moon's more poetic, dreamier qualities with its scientific aspects?
That's a great question. And some of the poets would say you can't. I think we can, and I try to do that in the book. I think science is beautiful. I think science is lyrical. And I say that as an outsider. I know many scientists, especially lab scientists, who go through sort of mind-numbingly routine activities in a lab or number crunching, and lyrical is the last thing that they would say about the process. Like, it's just, you work hard and you're doing sort of the same thing over and over again. But the outcomes are beautiful because it gets us closer to understanding the material world and reality. So I think science is a wonderful activity, and I think the moon offers us so much. I think poetry gives us, and the arts in general, give us a sense of connection. And I like to talk about leaping, that art leaps. It leaps through various associations. It leaps through various contrasts. Uses metaphor in various ways, not just written art, but you know, you could look at some painters as using color as metaphor. Well, what's a metaphor? It's a comparison. Well, actually, no, it's an assertion. It's like a multiple exposure in a photograph. It's overlaying one thing to another, and kind of gives us a way of thinking about the universe, particular objects, ourselves, that gives, I think, greater pause. So that is not, it's not unlike science. I live in that Venn diagram of art and science, and I see these things working together. And I can tell you, you know, of course, there are a lot of creatives, artists and so forth who aren't engaged in space, and that's fine. We each have our own obsessions. And there are a lot of engineers and policymakers and scientists who are not engaged necessarily in the arts, although we all consume entertainment and storytelling. We all have that investment in culture in that way. But it's in that meeting place between the two cultures. C.P. Snow said we had two cultures, arts and humanities and science and engineering. And I think that meeting place gets a little bit bigger each day. And the moon offers us a chance to see that growth. And one of the things you mentioned, Al Warden, I had the privilege of meeting him a couple times. We published one of his poems in Beyond Earth's Edge. And his sensibility, he writes, as you know, this beautiful memoir about Apollo 15 as the command module pilot. And he talks about the moon, the training that he and his fellow Apollo 15 crew members had is deep scientific training, the first really scientific expedition to the moon. And they take that awareness, that foreknowledge, and it allows them to connect to the moon, not only scientifically, but in a way we might say poetically. And for them, all three of them talk about the moon as a kind of home. There's a quote in Al's memoir where he says, the moon had become as familiar to him as the streets of his childhood. Mm. That's beautiful. And that, I think, that blending of science and poetry or the tools that artists can use. I hope very much to see more of that as Artemis returns to the moon.
Which leads me on to another question. So obviously you just spoke about Al Warden writing poetry when he came back, although he wasn't someone who before then was necessarily considered a poet, perhaps.
No.
That was something that came afterwards as his way of expressing what he was experiencing. So there's been a lot of talk about the idea of sending a poet to the moon. And if it ever happens, the Dear Moon mission might do just that in the next couple of years. Do you think the personal experiences of actually going to the moon would be a benefit to space poetry? Or do you think that actually the mystery is part of the magic?
I don't think the mystery goes away. I think it is enhanced by encounters. And that's the beauty of really good poetry. It gestures toward something ineffable. And I say that I'm a hard materialist, okay? So I'm not reaching for some spiritual realm in a sense. But there are aspects of our existence that will always remain, you know, paradoxical. Let's put it that way, right? So I think going to the moon, as in going to any other place, gives us a chance to hone our receptivity, our sensitivity, and our, which is a way of talking about ethics as well. I think description implies ethics. So I think poets going to any place, whether it's your living room or your backyard or a neighborhood park or a street in Brooklyn, whatever, we get to see something fresh and different because poetry and the other arts, but I'm speaking here from sort of my standpoint, will combine words and combine perspectives in ways that are surprising. A poem should be, not mean, as one famous poet said. And the Dear Moon mission seems to be on hold, and that's understandable because Starship needs to be proved out for Artemis, which is, you know, I think a bigger priority. Yeah. But ultimately, yes, writers, poets, dancers will go to space, will go to the moon. And Al Warden came back. He came back to write poetry because he had no other recourse. Like, that was the thing he reached for. This, you know, he is on the cutting edge of space exploration, right? He had just orbited the moon. He had gone farther than any human being to that point had gone before. And what does he do? He comes back, turns to an ancient form of communication. The only artist or the only astronaut to go to the moon, as you know, with formal artistic training is Alan Bean. Chance favors the prepared mind. So he comes back with the capacity to start painting some really gorgeous work, like real stuff, you know, real painting. This is formally sophisticated, beautiful work. And I believe that we need more of that. So if SpaceX or Blue Origin isn't going to send Julie Swarstead Johnson and myself to space, that's fine. But you know what? I'm going to argue actually in a forthcoming piece in Esquire about this very point. Like, let's give the astronauts workshops and metaphors. Let's give them workshops in fresh description. The storytelling preparation they get from the agency is really great and different from, you know, the Apollo era where they got nothing, right? They got nothing. Mike Massimino has talked to me about this, about the storytelling preparation that the astronauts get. And you can see his results speak for themselves. They're great. Yeah. He's a great storyteller. Poetry is a form of story, but it's more compressed. And that crystallization, I think, is really important to creating a fresh take on something, again, that we see in the night sky not infrequently.
So here's something I've never mentioned before on the podcast. So we have an exclusive episode 192, and we're still coming up with new things to talk about our personal lives. When I was 8 years old, I became a published poet.
Wow, I didn't know this. This
did
is
you
cool.
Write, did you write about the moon or rockets? Or
it was called The Planets. Okay.
Perfect.
So,
wow.
Yeah, I can remember it. Because it's not really a poem, and I think this may be a reflection on my teachers. It was one of those anthology books that they just, all the local kids from all the local schools, everyone wrote something. Pretty much everyone had their work put in this book. And mine said, Mercury, Venus, Earth and Mars are the inner planets. Jupiter, Saturn, Neptune, Uranus, and Pluto are the outer planets, and together they make up the solar system. That was what I thought was a poem. So, yes,
good,
but it
good
was
start.
Published.
Good
I'm a
start.
Published, I'm a published
good
poet.
Start.
Yeah,
good start.
Yeah.
Good start.
I could just about remember it. Anyway, my point was going to be, there may be people listening today who go, do you know what? I remember writing poetry when I was at school. I'd love to get back into that. And there are people that love looking at the stars and perhaps like you love looking through a telescope.
Yeah.
And that may be a great way for them to start because it's a subject they're passionate about. And when you're creating art, writing about what you're passionate about is important. However, when writing about space and things like that, it can be quite easy to fall into cliche. So do you have any advice for people that perhaps want to pick up a pen and a piece of paper today, want to look at the moon, write a poem about it, but not be cliched? Or should they not be scared of cliche, perhaps?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. I love this conversation this morning. We're deep into language. So, there are two or three things I would say. One, well, cliches are, they're useful. They're a form of shorthand, but and so we use them all the time, right? And that's fine. But when it comes to conveying an experience or a place, I think of it as a kind of empty dinner plate, you know, that I use a cliche. It's like I'm thinking off the top of my head, like the moon is a gray wasteland. And I hand that language to you, and then you sort of fill it in, like, what is that actually? What does a gray wasteland look like? And you draw on your own experiences. Of course, we do that all the time in even encountering poetry that's fresh and descriptive. You know, it's the reader, the receiver of the, you know, of the information, whether it's poetic or otherwise, does a lot of that work. But that's an empty kind of phrase, right? It doesn't convey the amphitheater effect of the crater Copernicus, which had these giant stair steps down at gray, white, and black to the hummocky floor of Copernicus that has been compared to the badlands of South Dakota and the western face of the Wasatch, where I live here in Utah, by science writers who were describing this in 1966 with an amazing photograph of the Copernicus crater, which people should look up. It's look up Copernicus 1966 picture of the century. You'll see it's the first really truly astonishing image from space. So, you know, I guess I would say don't be scared of anything and just write and write without censorship of self and just see where it takes you. There's some, you know, poetry and writing in general has this cathartic function and it helps us understand our experiences. So as a private activity, a kind of self-reflective activity, you know, everything from, you know, Marcus Aurelius writing his meditations to, you know, Sylvia Plath writing in her journal, that's crucial and that's important. It becomes a different sort of situation when you do want to put your work out there in the world. And of course, social media has changed that. We can post anything we want. But if we want to try to strive for language that's a little sharper, a little more descriptive, that does avoid cliches. And one of the struggles I had in my book about the moon and Still Is Bright was, how do I describe this? Like, this is another world. This is an extreme environment, another planet. I'm looking at through my telescope, but it's as though I'm orbiting a few hundred miles above. And so I leaned very heavily on metaphor. And, you know, I've been doing this for a while, so I have maybe a somewhat intuitive sense of where to reach for a different kind of language, the language of childhood or the language of science, and put that in conversation with the language of landscape. So I guess the other thing I would say, Dave, is just to read a lot, you know, to read poetry. Beyond Earth's Edge is a great, I mean, you know, yes, I have a vested interest in saying this, but it's a really good anthology, and you'll find
this
really vast array. We really wanted to make it as diverse as possible in every sort of way. And so stylistically, you're going to find poetry that's a little more approachable, maybe even say naive a little bit. I mean that not in a derogatory way, but then also poetry that's really experimental and really difficult. And I'm a trained reader. Like, I've got the English department stamp of approval. This is what I've done with my life. And then I encounter certain poems and certain texts, even still, it's like, this is hard, you know, this is challenging. So there's a great sort of democracy of approaches. in why we write and how we write and how we share that. So I don't know if I'm giving you a direct answer, but it's really just to encourage people to look at anything, and in that looking, maybe try to combine that with further reading, finding some reflective moments in our otherwise very busy lives, and then put your own pen to paper and see what happens.
That's awesome. Okay. Did your research and poetic work transform your views of the moon compared to how you may have viewed it earlier? Or was it kind of maybe the opposite way around, maybe even if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, it does. The research was transformative in just like deepening my relationship to it. Like I had this sort of blank spot, right, in my psyche regarding the history of the moon, basically prior to Apollo, right? Because again, I grew up, you know, watching those missions and been paying attention to Artemis and so forth, but only had the vaguest sense of like people followed the moon through the sky, and that's how you decided when you would plant things and when you harvest things, and it's been worshipped and philosophers have talked about it, et cetera, right? But then really delving into it gave me it's really deepened my relationship with this other world. Not surprisingly, like any place that we live, if we spend a little bit of time learning like the names of the plants, right? I learned the names of the craters. Well, you know, where I live, I learned the names of the plants. That becomes a significant part. Naming becomes a significant part of one's relationship to place. And that's, again, why I encourage people to look at the moon through the telescope. And not just look, like learn your way around a little bit. One of the funny things that happened in this book, I'll circle back to the larger question here, but one of the funny things that happened in the book was talking with lunar scientists. And, in a sense, sure, it's understandable. They're not, if you're studying the chemical makeup of particular rocks from the Apollo samples or what have you, and you're doing cosmochemistry on Mare Imbrium, one of the big lava plains on the moon, you probably aren't that interested in or don't have the time to look at the moon through the telescope and look at all these craters. And so I'd have these scientists say, I actually don't know my way around the moon at all. All these lunar scientists, I'm like, what? Let me have you for one or two evenings and we'll introduce the moon to you. I think that for me, any research, which sounds like a hard word, doesn't it? It's actually a form of, it's just curiosity, right? Reading and learning. So learning the cultural history of the moon was eye-opening. The depth of engagement that we've had over eons, right? And then the philosophical traditions, both in the Middle East and in Greece in particular, sort of struggling with, what is this thing? Is it an object? Is it a sacred light in the sky? And then seeing this just incredible transformation. Of course, knowing intellectually that Galileo's looking through the moon, or looking through the telescope at the moon, I should say, in 1609 was transformational. But really then reading about that and reading The Starry Messenger, which is still a really wonderful book, in which he describes the moon and he describes the satellites of Jupiter, and it sparks the scientific revolution. And so the role that the moon plays here, as I said, is outsized. It's really crucial. It's been an important part of our cultural and scientific history, as well as our biological history, having tides and different species that respond to the moon in different ways. So it all just deeply informed my sense of appreciation. I actually was talking with my wife a few days ago. The moon has been up and out in the clear skies here. And so I've been, and took the telescope out and took a look at it. It's like, I still like it. Like it's still this thing I really want to look at. And there's still a lot for me to learn in terms of my way around that landscape. And that's exciting. So there's, once a month I can spend some time exploring. Sandra Shapse, who is a philosopher, calls it the thick sublime. And that's what Apollo 15 experienced. The thick sublime is that, when we have a sublime moment, we're sort of taken out of ourselves, we encounter something bigger, something more dynamic, a storm or what have you. and a sense of wonder or awe. And that sense of sublime is, of course, part of why we love space and space exploration. But the more you know about it, actually, perhaps paradoxically, the better prepared you are to have that sublime experience. So I think that the reading and knowledge and interviewing astronauts and all of the things that went into the book just enhanced my appreciation for this, you know, this companion world of ours.
Wow. I love that phrase, the thick sublime.
Yeah,
isn't that amazing? It's something that I love the way it sounds, but I'm not sure if I've experienced it. I think maybe the closest I've gotten to experiencing it was seeing Saturn through a telescope once.
Yeah.
Because, you know, you see pictures of Saturn and it's nice to see pictures, but when you see it with your eyeballs, you're like, this is a destination. Like, this is an actual, does that make sense? Like,
yeah.
Wow. I want to experience that again. That's the thing. Like but I think I know what that feeling is, but it's hard to qualify.
Hard to put into words. And this sort of comes back to what Dave was saying earlier. And so when we have a sublime experience, we pass through a phase. I think there's a whole, you know, literature and scientific in now neuroscience of the, you know, the science of wonder. It's kind of wordless. Like, it takes us outside of ourselves. It takes us outside of language. But there is this recovery then. And then we're faced with the prospect like, how do I convey that? You know, how do I convey looking at Saturn through the telescope or on a terrestrial terms, seeing a very vivid memory of being on a mountainside in Utah with this approaching storm front. And, you know, lightning and thunder. And of course, that's, you don't want to be on a mountain. And so there was an element of risk and danger. And of course, you get away from that, you know, you go down. It's like, how do I, in just a few seconds, I just, you know, snapshotted the experience, but that's inadequate. And so language and representation of the sublime is always inadequate, yet we are compelled to try to convey it because we're hardwired to share our experiences. And I think we're hardwired, and I think the neuroscience is showing us, like, we're hardwired to have an experience in which our ego is diminished, right? And whether that's going into a cathedral and seeing light streaming through stained glass, watching a rocket launch, standing at the edge of a canyon, okay, having those moments, and there are all kinds of questions of gender and class and place and demographic that start to get embedded in this, like, who has access to places and experiences like that? Again, the telescope can give that democratically, right? Borrow a telescope from the public library, you can look at the moon, you can experience the sublime. And the more you know about it, I think, again, chance favors the prepared mind. But the paradox is then, how do we talk about it? How do we convey it?
Well, this has been a wonderful interview. Thank you so much for talking to us, Christopher.
Yeah, this has been amazing.
Yeah, I hope our listeners go and check out your new book. I will be putting links in the show notes so that people can go and find it and find out all the lovely things that some very cool people have been saying about it as well, which is must be fun for you.
Very gratifying, yes.
Absolutely. But we hope to speak to you soon and wish you all the best with it.
Dave, Emily, thank you so much. I'm a fan.
Thank you.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
Every single place in the observable universe is either space or a thing. So this podcast is really about everything.
That interview was really amazing. I love that somebody is talking about the poetic expression and space flight, because a big example we used during that interview was Al Warden coming back from the moon, and he didn't really have a way to express it other than writing poetry. You know, he came back from the moon and there was like a party every day at his house, like, wow, when he came back. Like, every day people were partying on down at his house. You know, it was like a big celebration when he came back, basically, for weeks. You know, when the dust kind of settled, he was still sort of in this state of like, what did I just see? Like, what did I just experience? You know, and it was like, how do I put this in words? He was still in a real state of awe over what he experienced, but he didn't really know what to do about it. So he just started writing, like, it was almost automatic. Yeah. Like, he started to write poetry that just came out. He is an excellent writer. If you read his books, you'll know he's got a good way with words. But, you know, it wasn't something he really pursued before, you know, that happened. But I think that was the only way mentally he could express it. And I noticed in his later months, before he passed, when he went to events to speak about his experience, he would read his poetry. I'm about to start crying thinking about this. But he would read his poetry because that was how he best could express his experience. I just think that's amazing that somebody like Christopher is exploring this phenomenon. And I love that phrase he used, the thick sublime. I love that because I think I may have experienced that at certain times of my life, but I didn't know how to express what it was. You know, it's just this feeling of like, oh my gosh, this is, but you can't really put it in words. Like, there's been certain rocket launches I've been to where you just feel like you feel that sense, and it's just the weirdest feeling. And I loved how he brought that up. So I don't know. It's hard to put in words, but I'm glad somebody is discussing this.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's nice that we've got a book that's about the history of the moon by someone who understands poetry and understands language. And I think that adds a different level to what we're learning, how we learn. And that thick sublime, I love that. When I keep talking about my childhood. Well, I think it was about the same age. I may have been 8 or 9, maybe a bit younger. I can't remember. My great grandmother, she died, and I got an inheritance of £100 that I was told by my mum and dad to do something special with, because it was obviously the biggest amount of money that I'd ever had at that point. Yeah. And that was a hell of a lot of money for a child to have. So I looked in we have a shop in England called Argos, which is, there's a catalogue and you go in, and it's got something of everything, and you go you write the number
like
down.
Sears.
Maybe, but it's not a department store. It's literally like a warehouse with a counter, and you go
I know what you're... Okay.
And everything's behind.
Canada used to have something like that.
We'd always get the catalogue because for kids, it was great because you could see all the new toys that had come out and make your wish list. Because obviously, the internet didn't exist back then, right? So that's how you figured out what you liked, right? And what you wanted.
We had that in the States. It was the wish book, and you get the wish book at Christmas, and you'd circle all the stuff.
There you go.
Similar.
So within this book, there was a telescope that was £99.99. So I said I would like to spend my great nan's money, little big nanny's money, on a telescope. So off we went, bought the telescope. I don't know what I did with the other penny. Sorry, Nan. Don't know what I did with the other penny. But bought this telescope.
She'll forgive you.
Set it up and pointed it at the moon. And because I was never very good at that age at finding the other planets or anything like that in the sky. And we didn't have apps that helped us out, you know.
Yeah, we didn't have pointing apps.
But the moon I could see. All right, so I could,
it's right there.
I can get it, right? And I remember setting it up, finding the moon in it, and calling out to mum and dad, come up, have a look. And my mum's reaction, she was very emotional about seeing the moon through a telescope. Now, this is the moon that's been in the sky the whole of their life, something that's been with them.
Yeah.
I guess we kind of spoke about this when the Queen died. She's been there the whole of our life.
And yeah, all known this.
Yeah, exactly. So to then experience it in a different way is very odd. And the thick sublime, I guess, is the experience that my mum had looking at the moon for a telescope. Because it became 3D. It became real. I don't know. It was different. Like you see photos of it, but when you see it through a telescope, through your own eyes up close.
Yeah. And it has a texture to it, and it bulges out.
Yeah.
The whole time Christopher was talking, I kept thinking, I'm sorry to interrupt you. I kept thinking of the passage in Carrying the Fire where Mike Collins talks about seeing the moon for the first time and how it had different colors and it bulged out and it had three dimensions. And there's a great passage. I haven't memorized it verbatim, but it kind of reminded me of that in a way.
Yeah, for sure. And for those people who have gone to see the Moonwalkers exhibit, whatever it is, show that's happening in London at the moment that Tom Hanks has put his voice to and narrated, he talks about the moon.
Yeah.
He talks about how it's been in the sky forever and how when we look at the moon, we're looking at the same thing that people looked at 400 years ago, 500 years ago, 1,000 years ago.
Yeah.
See, it's not changed a hell of a lot in the sky
No.
So we have that same experience that connects us back to the early days of humanity and history.
The cavemen.
And it's there. It's right there. All you got to do is you look there and you can see history. And there's that connection. Yep. And it's such a powerful thing. And Chris's book, which explores all these ideas as well, I think it's something that we all need to be aware of. We just take it for granted it's there, and actually taking a moment to stop and think about it and why it's there and what it means, and culturally what it has meant, spiritually what it has meant. I think we may have mentioned this before, and it's something we need to talk about, the ethics of going to the moon, because of all the religious implications that has back on Earth. It's something we need to talk about because we haven't done, and it's something that I wasn't aware of until recently. But I think the more we talk about these things, the more we understand how other people experience the moon. It makes
space habitation, because I feel like, I'm sorry to talk over you. Oh my God. But space habitation, I feel like that's going to open the doors for people to have like Target on the moon or Walmart on the moon or corporations on the moon. Do we really want that? Do we want shopping on them? I mean, I think about that because there's going to come a time where there might be enough people up there and they might have a Starbucks up there or just something, you know? And I think about that. And what are the ethical implications of, do we want capitalism up there? Do we want, what kind of economic system does the moon get? What countries does it resemble? You know, just a lot of questions about that stuff. I don't know how to answer that,
right.
You know, and I'm probably not the one who should be answering that at all, you know?
I don't know.
I shouldn't be making that decision.
I think you'd put Space Mountain on the moon. I think that would...
Yeah, I would.
A place to buy some Mickey ears.
I would probably, Space Mountain on the moon would hit different. It would definitely hit different. It would be a different experience. Yeah, I would probably do that, but still, you know? But maybe I'm not the best person to ask, you know? That's the thing, you know? Who gets to make those just... Seriously, like, there's going to come a point where it's like, okay, who gets to make those decisions of what do we put, what kind of things from a paying perspective do we put on the moon, and is this ethical or not? Do we want to do this, you know?
Yeah. I think the reason I like this interview is because it reminded me to not be afraid of the emotional impact of the moon, and to not forget that you can have an emotional connection to the moon, and expressing that is quite hard and quite difficult because it's just something that's there in the sky. And using things like poetry and other art forms is a really cool way of figuring it out. So I'd be interested to hear from our listeners if you have any particular emotional stories connected to the moon that you might want to express as poetry. I think it'd be really cool if we got a few people send some stuff in. And if you wouldn't mind, perhaps we'll read some of them out in future shows.
That's a great idea.
If people want to send some stuff in, I'd love to have a poetry section on the show. So
a great idea.
Yeah, you could just be about all things space, but I think this episode is really focused on the moon, and I think that should be our focal point over the next few weeks. And if I can find the anthology that has my original space poem, my published space poem.
We'd love
poem.
To hear it.
I'll put that on social media. It's got to be in one of my bookshelves over there.
Yeah.
Somewhere. Anyway.
Seriously, that is a great idea. I'd love to hear what people have to offer. You know, I think that's awesome.
Absolutely.
That's a great idea, Dave.
So if you would like to watch the full unedited interview with Christopher, then head over to patreon.com/spaceandthings. And look in the show notes if you would like to know more about his new book or his other books, and or just find out more about Christopher in general.
You're listening to Space and Things, the only modern podcast not about serial killers.
So, Emily, what has caught your eye this week in spaceflight?
Two articles caught my eye. One is by phys.org, phys.org, physics.org. NASA is currently working to resume science operations of Hubble Space Telescope. It entered a safe mode on April 23rd because of a gyroscope issue. Other than that, the telescope is in good health. Just a heads up, Hubble is 34 years old, which is actually pretty insane for a spacecraft to be that old and still functioning fairly well. So currently NASA is working on troubleshooting that. And another article, I thought this was really cool. NASA's Psyche spacecraft has hit 25 MBPs from 140 million miles away. It has an optical communications demonstration instrument. That's according to this article by theregister.com, which I have sent Dave. That's about good enough to get Netflix, Ultra HD Netflix. So maybe, who knows, we can get a market for Netflix in space someday. Some of you may remember, a few months ago in December, that I think the same tech demo sent a video from deep space of Taters the cat doing orange cat stuff, chasing a laser. So that's pretty amazing. That kind of tells you how advanced they're getting with space communications nowadays using lasers. So I'm very excited to see what happens with that. And that's really all I've got this week. So has anything caught your eye this week, Dave?
Yeah, just the fact that we have the hopefully in the next week, the launch of the Starliner spacecraft with a crew on board.
Yes!
Which is scheduled to take place on May the 6th. So I will put links to articles about what Emily spoke about and an article about the Starliner launch in the show notes, which you can find on spaceandthingspodcast.com or by clicking in the link in the description of this podcast episode in your podcast provider.
That's one small step for... Oh my... What is that thing?
Thank you for joining us this week. We're coming up on our 200th episode, which is something I never thought I'd say, but there you go. We appreciate everyone who has ever listened to us talk about space and things too, but mostly space. Please help us continue to make these episodes by spreading the word about what we do. Just share the link of the podcast with your friends who like space. We've got 192 episodes in the bank. You'd think there'd be at least one they might like.
Yes, and of course, as always, thanks to our Patreon subscribers. It means so much to us that people are willing to financially back what we're doing here. And if you're willing and able to do that, please head over to patreon.com/spaceandthings. We'll be back with more Space and Things next week. But until then, don't forget, in space, no one can hear you mean.